It was a wonder that his statue did not crumble at the sight of her bare breasts. Tyrion used to say that King Balor was terrified of his own cock. Once, she recalled, he had expelled all the whores from King's Landing. He prayed for them, as they were driven from the city gates, the history said, but would not look at them. "Harlot!" a voice screamed. Another woman. Something flew out of the crowd. Some rotted vegetable. Brown and oozing, it sailed above her head to splash at the foot of one of the poor fellows. "I'm not afraid. I am a lioness," she walked on. "Hot pies!" the baker's boy was crying. "Get sharp pies here!" Septa Scalera rang her bell, singing, "Shame, shame, shame upon the sinner! Shame, shame!" The poor fellows went before them, forcing men aside with their shields, walling off a narrow path. Cersei followed where they led, her head held stiffly, her eyes on the far distance. Every step brought the Red Keep nearer. Every step brought her closer to her son and her salvation. It seemed to take 100 years to cross the plaza, but finally marble gave way to cobblestones beneath her feet. Shops and stables and houses closed in all around them, and they began the descent of Visenya's Hill. The going was slower here. The street was steep and narrow, the crowds jammed together tightly. The poor fellows shoved at those who blocked the way, trying to move them aside. But there was nowhere to go, and those in the back of the crowd were shoving back. Cersei tried to keep her head up, only to step in something slick and wet that made her slip. She might have fallen, but Septa Eunella caught her arm and kept her on her feet. "Your Grace should watch where she sets her feet." Cersei wrenched herself free. "Yes, Septa," she said in a meek voice, though she was angry enough to spit. The queen walked on, clad only in goose prickles and pride. She looked for the Red Keep, but it was hidden now, walled off from her gaze by the tall timbered buildings to either side. "Shame! Shame!" sang Septa Scalera, her bell clanging. Cersei tried to walk faster, but soon came up against the backs of the stars in front of her and had to slow her steps again. A man just ahead was selling skewers of roast meat from a cart, and the procession halted as the poor fellows moved him out of the way. The meat looked suspiciously like rat to Cersei's eyes, but the smell of it filled the air, and half the men around them were gnawing away with sticks in hand by the time the street was clear enough for her to resume her trek. "Want some, Your Grace?" one man called out. He was a big, burly brute with pig eyes, a massive gut, and an unkempt black beard that reminded her of Robert. When she looked away in disgust, he flung the skewer at her. It struck her on the leg and tumbled to the street, and the half-cooked meat left a smear of grease and blood down her thigh. The shouting seemed louder here than on the plaza, perhaps because the mob was so much closer. "Whore and sinner" were most common, but "brother fucker" and "cunt" and "traitor" were flung at her as well. And now and again she heard someone shout out for Stannis or Margaery. The cobbles underfoot were filthy, and there was so little space that the queen could not even walk around the puddles. "No one has ever died of wet feet," she told herself. She wanted to believe the puddles were just rainwater, though horse piss was just as likely. More refuse showered down from windows and balconies, half-rotted fruit, pails of beer, eggs that exploded into sulphurous stink when they cracked open on the ground. Then someone flung a dead cat over the poor fellows and warriors' sons alike. The carcass hit the cobble so hard that it burst open, spattering her lower legs with entrails and maggots. Cersei walked on. "I am blind and deaf, and they are worms," she told herself. "Shame, shame," the scepter sang. "Chestnuts "Hot roast chestnuts!" a peddler cried. "Queen cunt!" a drunkard pronounced solemnly from a balcony above, lifting his cup to her in a mocking toast. "All hail the royal teats!" "Words are wind," Cersei thought. "Words cannot arm me." Halfway down Visenya's hill, the queen fell for the first time, when her foot slipped in something that might have been night soil. When Septa Eunella pulled her up, her knee was scraped and bloody. A ragged laugh rippled through the crowd, and some man shouted out an offer to kiss it and make it better. Cersei looked behind her. She could still see the great dome and seven crystal towers of the great Sept of Baelor atop the hill. "Have I really just come such a little way?" Worse, 100 times worse, she had lost sight of the Red Keep.
"Where? Where?"
"Your Grace," the captain of her escort stepped up beside her. Cersei had forgotten his name. "You must continue. The crowd is growing unruly." "Yes," she thought, "unruly. I am not afraid. You should be." He yanked at her arm, pulling her along beside him. She staggered down the hill, downward, ever downward, wincing with every step, letting him support her. "It should be Jaime beside me." He would draw his golden sword and slash a path right through the mob, carving the eyes out of the head of every man who dared to look at her. The paving stones were cracked and uneven, slippery underfoot, and rough against her soft feet. Her heel came down on something sharp, a stone or piece of broken crockery. Cersei cried out in pain. "I asked for sandals," she spat at Septa Eunella. "You could have given me sandals? You could have done that much?" The knight wrenched at her arm again, as if she were some common serving wench. "Has he forgotten who I am? She was the queen of Westeros. He had no right to lay rough hands on her." Near the bottom of the hill, the slope gentled, and the street began to widen. Cersei could see the Red Keep again, shining crimson in the morning sun atop Aegon's high hill. "I must keep walking." She wrenched free of Sir Theodan's grasp. "You do not need to drag me, sir." She limped on, leaving a trail of bloody footprints on the stones behind her. She walked through mud and dung, bleeding, goose-fleshed, hobbling. All around her was a babble of sound.
"My wife is sweeter teats than those," a man shouted.
A teamster cursed as the poor fellows ordered his wagon out of the way.
"Shame, shame, shame on the sinner," chanted the scepters. "Look at this one,"
a whore called from a brothel window, lifting her skirts to the men below.
"It's not had half as many cocks up it as hers."
Bells were ringing, ringing, ringing.
"That can't be the queen," a boy said. "She's saggy as my mum."
"This is my penance," Cersei told herself. "I have sinned most grievously. This is my atonement. It will be over soon. It will be behind me. Then I can forget." The queen began to see familiar faces. A bald man with bushy side whiskers frowned down from a window with her father's frown, and for an instant looked so much like Lord Tywin that she stumbled. A young girl sat beneath a fountain, drenched in spray, and stared at her with Malara Heatherspoon's accusing eyes. She saw Ned Stark, and beside him little Sansa, with her auburn hair and a shaggy grey dog that might have been her wolf. Every child squirming through the crowd became her brother Tyrion, jeering at her as he had jeered when Joffrey died. And there was Joff as well, her son, her firstborn, her beautiful, bright boy, with his golden curls and his sweet smile. He had such lovely lips. That was when she fell the second time. She was shaking like a leaf when they pulled her to her feet.
"Please," she said, "Mother, have mercy. I confessed." "You did,"
said Septimoel. "This is your atonement."
"It is not much farther," said Septimoel. "See?" she pointed. "Up the hill, that's all."
"Up the hill, that's all?" It was true. They were at the foot of Aegon's high hill, the castle above them.
"Hur!"
someone screamed.
"Brother Fokker,"
another voice added.
"Abomination! Want to suck on this, your grace?"
A man in a butcher's apron pulled his cock out of his breeches, grinning. It did not matter. She was almost home. Cersei began to climb. If anything, the jeers and shouts were cruder here. Her walk had not taken her through Flea Bottom, so its denizens had packed onto the lower slopes of Aegon's High Hill to see the show. The faces leering out at her from behind the shields and spears of the poor fellows seemed twisted, monstrous, hideous. Pigs and naked children were everywhere underfoot. Crippled beggars and cutpurses swarmed like roaches through the press. She saw men whose teeth had been filed into points, hags with goiters as big as their heads, a whore with a huge striped snake draped about her breasts and shoulders, a man whose cheeks and brow were covered with open sores that wept grey pus. They grinned and licked their lips and hooted at her as she went limping past, her breasts heaving with the effort of the climb. Some shouted obscene proposals, others insults.
"Words are wind," she thought. "Words cannot hurt me. I am beautiful, the most beautiful woman in all Westeros. Jaime says so. Jaime would never lie to me. Even Robert. Robert never loved me, but he saw that I was beautiful. He wanted me."
She did not feel beautiful, though. She felt old, used, filthy, ugly. There were stretch marks on her belly from the children she had borne, and her breasts were not as firm as they had been when she was younger. Without a gown to hold them up, they sagged against her chest. "I should not have done this. I was their queen. But now they've seen, they've seen, they've seen. I should never have let them see." Gowned and crowned, she was a queen. Naked, bloody, limping, she was only a woman. Not so very different from their wives, more like their mothers than their pretty little maiden daughters. "What have I done?" There was something in her eyes, stinging, blurring her sight. She could not cry. She would not cry. The worms must never see her weep. Cersei rubbed her eyes with the heels of her hands. A gust of cold wind made her shiver violently. And suddenly, the hag was there, standing in the crowd with her pendulous teats and her warty, greenish skin, leering with the rest, with malice shining from her crusty, yellow eyes.
"Queen, you shall be," she hissed, "until there comes another, younger and more beautiful, to cast you down and take all you hold most dear."
And then there was no stopping the tears. They burned down the queen's cheeks like acid. Cersei gave a sharp cry, covered her nipples with one arm, slid the other down to hide her slit, and began to run, shoving her way past the line of poor fellows, crouching as she scrambled crab-legged up the hill. Partway up, she stumbled and fell, rose and fell again 10 yards further on. The next thing she knew, she was crawling, scrambling uphill on all fours like a dog as the good folk of King's Landing made way for her, laughing and jeering and applauding her. Then all at once, the crowd parted and seemed to dissolve, and there were the castle gates before her and a line of spearmen in gilded half-helms and crimson cloaks. Cersei heard the gruff, familiar sound of her uncle growling orders, and glimpse of flash of white to either side as Sir Boris Blunt and Sir Meryn Trant strode toward her in their pale plate and snowy cloaks.
"My son!" she cried.
Where is my son? Where is Tommen?
Not here. No son should have to bear witness to his mother's shame. Sir Kevin's voice was harsh. Cover her up. Then Jocelyn was bending over her, wrapping her in a soft, clean blanket of green wool to cover up her nakedness. A shadow fell across them both, blotting out the sun. The queen felt cold steel slide beneath her, a pair of great armored arms lifting her off the ground, lifting her up into the air as easily as she had lifted Joffrey when he was still a babe. A giant, thought Cersei, dizzy as he carried her with great strides toward the gatehouse. She had heard that giants could still be found in the godless wild beyond the wall.
That is just a tale. Am I dreaming?
No. Her savior was real. 8 feet tall, or maybe taller, with legs as thick around as trees. He had a chest worthy of a plough horse, and shoulders that would not disgrace an ox. His armor was plate steel, enameled white and bright as a maiden's hopes, and worn over gilded mail. A great helm hid his face. From its crest streamed 7 silken plumes in the rainbow colors of the faith. A pair of golden 7-pointed stars clasped his billowing cloak at the shoulders. A white cloak? Sir Kevin had kept his part of the bargain. Tommen, her precious little boy, had named her champion to the King's Guard. Cersei never saw where Qyburn came from, but suddenly he was there beside them, scrambling to keep up with her champion's long strides. "Your Grace," he said, "it is so good to have you back. May I have the honour of presenting our newest member of the King's Guard? This is Sir Robert Strong."
"Sir Robert," Cersei whispered as they entered the gates.
"If it please your Grace, Sir Robert has taken a holy vow of silence," Qyburn said. "He has sworn that he will not speak until all of his Grace's enemies are dead, and evil has been driven from the realm."
Yes, thought Cersei Lannister. Oh, yes.
Sansa. The throne room was a sea of jewels, furs, and bright fabrics. Lords and ladies filled the back of the hall and stood beneath the high windows, jostling like fishwives on a dock. The denizens of Joffrey's court had striven to outdo each other today. Jalabar Zoe was all in feathers, a plumage so fantastic and extravagant that he seemed like to take flight. The High Septon's crystal crown fired rainbows through the air every time he moved his head. At the council table, Queen Cersei shimmered in a cloth of gold gown slashed in burgundy velvet, while beside her Varys fussed and simpered in a lilac brocade. Moonboy and Sir Dontus wore new suits of motley, clean as a spring morning. Even Lady Tanda and her daughters looked pretty in matching gowns of turquoise silk and vair, and Lord Giles was coughing into a square of scarlet silk trimmed with golden lace. King Joffrey sat above them all, amidst the blades and barbs of the Iron Throne. He was in crimson samite, his black mantle studded with rubies, on his head his heavy golden crown. Squirming through a press of knights, squires, and rich townfolk, Sansa reached the front of the gallery just as a blast of trumpets announced the entry of Lord Tywin Lannister. He rode his warhorse down the length of the hall and dismounted before the Iron Throne. Sansa had never seen such armor, all burnished red steel, inlaid with golden scrollwork and ornamentation. His rundles were sunbursts. The roaring lion that crowned his helm had ruby eyes, and a lioness on each shoulder fastened a cloth of gold cloak so long and heavy that it draped the hindquarters of his charger. Even the horse's armor was gilded, and his bardings were shimmering crimson silk emblazoned with the Lion of Lannister. The Lord of Castle Rock made such an impressive figure that it was a shock when his destrier dropped a load of dung right at the base of the throne. Joffrey had to step gingerly around it as he descended to embrace his grandfather and proclaim him savior of the city. Sansa covered her mouth to hide a nervous smile. Joff made a show of asking his grandfather to assume governance of the realm, and Lord Tywin solemnly accepted the responsibility, until your grace does come of age. Then Squires removed his armor, and Joff fastened the hand's chain of office around his neck. Lord Tywin took a seat at the council table beside the queen. After the destrier was led off and his homage removed, Cersei nodded for the ceremonies to continue. A fanfare of brazen trumpets greeted each of the heroes as he stepped between the great oak doors. Heralds cried his name and deeds for all to hear, and the noble knights and highborn ladies cheered as lustily as cutthroats at a cockfight. Pride of place was given to Mace Tyrell, the Lord of Highgarden, a once powerful man gone to fat, yet still handsome. His sons followed him in, Sir Loras and his older brother, Sir Garland the Gallant. The three dressed alike in green velvet trimmed with sable. The king descended the throne once more to greet them, a great honour. He fastened about the throat of each a chain of roses wrought in soft yellow gold, from which hung a golden disc with the Lion of Lannister picked out in rubies. "The roses support the lion, as the might of Highgarden supports the realm," proclaimed Joffrey. "If there is any boon you would ask of me, ask, and it shall be yours." "And now it comes," thought Sansa. "Your grace," said Sir Loras, "I beg the honour of serving in your king's guard to defend you against your enemies." Joffrey drew the Knight of Flowers to his feet and kissed him on his cheek. "Done, brother." Lord Tyrell bowed his head. "There is no greater pleasure than to serve the king's grace. If I were deemed worthy to join your royal council, you will find none more loyal or true." Joff put a hand on Lord Tyrell's shoulder and kissed him when he stood. "Your wish is granted." Sir Garland Tyrell, 5 years senior to Sir Loras, was a taller, bearded version of his more famous younger brother. He was thicker about the chest and broader at the shoulders, and though his face was comely enough, he lacked Sir Loras's startling beauty. "Your grace," Garland said when the king approached him, "I have a maiden sister, Margaery, the delight of our house. She was to wed Renly Baratheon, as you know, but Lord Renly went to war before the marriage could be consummated, so she remains innocent. Margaery has heard tales of your wisdom, courage, and chivalry, and has come to love you from afar. I beseech you to send for her, to take her hand in marriage, and to wed your house to mine for all time." King Joffrey made a show of looking surprised. "Sir Garland, your sister's beauty is famed throughout the Seven Kingdoms, but I am promised to another. A king must keep his word." Queen Cersei got to her feet in a rustle of skirts. "Your grace, in the judgment of your small council, it would be neither proper nor wise for you to wed the daughter of a man beheaded for treason, a girl whose brother is in open rebellion against the throne even now. Sir, your counsellors beg you, for the good of your realm, set Sansa Stark aside. The Lady Margaery will make you a far more suitable queen." Like a pack of trained dogs, the lords and ladies in the hall began to shout their pleasure. "Margaery," they called, "give us Margaery!" And, "No traitor queens, Tyrell, Tyrell!" Joffrey raised a hand. "I would like to heed the wishes of my people, mother, but I took a holy vow." The High Septon stepped forward. "Your grace, the guards hold betrothal solemn, but your father, King Robert of blessed memory, made this pact before the Starks of Winterfell had revealed their falseness. Their crimes against the realm have freed you from any promise you might have made. So far as the faith is concerned, there is no valid marriage contract betwixt you and Sansa Stark." A tumult of cheering filled the throne room, and cries of "Marjorie! Marjorie!" erupted all around her. Sansa leaned forward, her hands tight, around the gallery's wooden rail. She knew what came next, but she was still frightened of what Joffrey might say, afraid that he would refuse to release her even now, when his whole kingdom depended upon it. She felt as if she were back again, on the marble steps outside the great sept of Baelor, waiting for her prince to grant her father mercy, and instead hearing him command Ilion Payne to strike off his head. "Please," she prayed fervently, "make him say it. Make him say it." Lord Tywin was looking at his grandson. Joffrey gave him a sullen glance, shifted his feet, and helped Sir Garland Tyrell to rise. "The guards are good. I am free to heed my heart. I will wed your sweet sister, and gladly, sir." He kissed Sir Garland on a bearded cheek as the cheers rose all around them. Sansa felt curiously light-headed. "I am free." She could feel eyes upon her. "I must not smile," she reminded herself. The queen had warned her, no matter what she felt inside, the face she showed the world must look distraught. "I will not have my son humiliated," Cersei said. "Do you hear me?"
"Yes, but if I am not to be queen, what will become of me?"
"That will need to be determined. For the moment, you shall remain here at court as our ward."
"I want to go home."
The queen was irritated by that. "You should have learned by now, none of us get the things we want."
"I have, though," Sansa thought. "I am free of Joffrey. I will not have to kiss him, nor give him my maidenhood, nor bear him children. Let Marjorie Tyrell have all that, poor girl."
By the time the outburst died down, the Lord of Highgarden had been seated at the council table, and his sons had joined the other knights and lordlings beneath the windows. Sansa tried to look forlorn and abandoned as other heroes of the Battle of the Blackwater were summoned forth to receive their rewards. Paxter Redwine, Lord of the Arbor, marched down the length of the hall flanked by his twin sons, Horror and Slubber, the former limping from a wound taken in the battle. After them followed Lord Mathis Rowan, in a snowy doublet with a great tree worked upon the breast in gold thread. Lord Randall Tarley, lean and balding, a great sword across his back in a jewel scabbard. Sir Kevin Lannister, a thick-set balding man with a close-trimmed beard. Sir Adam Marbrand, coppery hair streaming to his shoulders. The great Western lords, Lyddon, Crakehall, and Brax. Next came four of lesser birth, who had distinguished themselves in the fighting. The one-eyed knight, Sir Philip Foot, who had slain Lord Bryce Caron in single combat. The free rider, Lothar Brune, who cut his way through half a hundred fussaway men-at-arms to capture Sir John of the Green Apple and kill Sir Brian and Sir Edward of the Red, thereby winning himself the name Lothar Apple-Eater. Willett, a grizzled man-at-arms in the service of Sir Harry Swift, who pulled his master from beneath his dying horse and defended him against a dozen attackers, and a downy-cheeked squire named Josmyn Peckledon, who had killed two knights, wounded a third, and captured two more, though he could not have been more than 14. Willett was borne in on a litter, so grievous were his wounds. Sir Kevin had taken a seat beside his brother, Lord Tywin. When the herald had finished telling of each hero's deeds, he rose. "It is his grace's wish that these good men be rewarded for their valour. By his decree, Sir Philip shall henceforth be Lord Philip of House Foot, and to him shall go all the lands, rights, and incomes of House Caron. Lothar Brune to be raised to the estate of knighthood, and granted lands and keep in the riverlands at War's End. To Josmyn Peckledon, a sword and suit of plate, his choice of any war horse in the royal stables, and knighthood as soon as he shall come of age. And lastly, for Goodman Willett, a spear with a silver-banded haft, a hauberk of new forged ringmail, and a full helm with visor. Further, the good man's sons shall be taken into the service of House Lannister at Casterly Rock, the elder as a squire and the younger as a page, with a chance to advance to knighthood if they serve loyally and well. To all this, the king's hand and the small council consent. The captains of the king's warships, Wildwind, Prince Aemon, and River Arrow, were honoured next, along with some under-officers from God's Grace, Lance, Lady of Silk, and Ram's Head. As near as Sansa could tell, their chief accomplishment had been surviving the battle on the river, a feat that few enough could boast. Hailin the Pyromancer and the Masters of the Alchemist Guild received the king's thanks as well, and Hailin was raised to the style of Lord, though Sansa noted that neither lands nor castle accompanied the title, which made the alchemist no more a true lord than Varys was. A more significant lordship by far was granted to Sir Lancel Lannister. Joffrey awarded him the lands, castle, and rights of House Dairy, whose last child lord had perished during the fighting in the Riverlands, leaving no true-born heirs of lawful Dairy blood, but only a bastard cousin. Sir Lancel did not appear to accept the title. The talk was his wound might cost him his arm or even his life. The imp was said to be dying as well, from a terrible cut to the head. When the herald called, "Lord Petar Baelish," he came forth, dressed all in shades of rose and plum, his cloak patterned with mockingbirds. She could see him smiling as he knelt before the Iron Throne. He looked so pleased. Sansa had not heard of Littlefinger doing anything especially heroic during the battle, but it seemed he was to be rewarded all the same. Sir Kevin got back to his feet. "It is the wish of the King's Grace that his loyal counsellor, Petar Baelish, be rewarded for faithful service to crown and realm. Be it known that Lord Baelish is granted the castle of Harrenhal, with all its attendant lands and incomes, there to make his seat and rule henceforth, as Lord Paramount of the Trident. Petar Baelish and his sons and grandsons shall hold and enjoy these honours until the end of time, and all the lords of the Trident shall do him homage as their rightful liege. The king's hand and the small council consent." On his knees, Littlefinger raised his eyes to King Joffrey.
"I thank you humbly, Your Grace. I suppose this means I'll need to see about getting some sons and grandsons."
Joffrey laughed, and the court with him.
Lord Paramount of the Trident, Sansa thought, and Lord of Harrenhal as well.
She did not understand why that should make him so happy. The honours were as empty as the title granted to Hailin the Pyromancer. Harrenhal was cursed. Everyone knew that, and the Lannisters did not even hold it at present. Besides, the Lords of the Trident were sworn to Riverrun and House Tully, and to the King in the North. They would never accept Littlefinger as their liege.
"Unless they are made to. Unless my brother and my uncle and my grandfather are all cast down and killed." The thought made Sansa anxious, but she told herself she was being silly. "Rob has beaten them every time. He'll beat Lord Baelish too, if he must."
More than 600 new knights were made that day. They had held their vigil in the great Sept of Baelor all through the night, and crossed the city barefoot that morning to prove their humble hearts. Now they came forward, dressed in shifts of undyed wool, to receive their knighthoods from the King's Guard. It took a long time, since only three of the Brothers of the White Sword were on hand to dub them. Mandan Moor had perished in the battle. The Hound had vanished. Aerys Oakheart was in Dorn with Princess Myrcella, and Jaime Lannister was Robb's captive. So the King's Guard had been reduced to Balon Swan, Merrin Trant, and Osmond Kettleblack. Once knighted, each man rose, buckled on his sword belt, and stood beneath the windows. Some had bloody feet from their walk through the city, but they stood tall and proud all the same, it seemed to Sansa. By the time all the new knights had been given their sirs, the hall was growing restive, and none more so than Joffrey.
Some of those in the gallery had begun to slip quietly away, but the notables on the floor were trapped, unable to depart without the king's leave. Judging by the way he was fidgeting atop the iron throne, Joff would willingly have granted it, but the day's work was far from done. For now, the coin was turned over, and the captives were ushered in. There were great lords and noble knights in that company, too. Tsar old Lord Celtigar, the Red Crab, Sir Bonifer the Good, Lord Estamont, more ancient even than Celtigar, Lord Varna, who hobbled the length of the hall on a shattered knee but would accept no help, Sir Mark Mullendore, grey-faced, his left arm gone to the elbow, Fierce Red Runnet of Griffin Roost, Sir Dermot of the Rainwood, Lord Willem and his sons, Joshua and Elias, Sir John Fussaway, Sir Timon the Scrapesword, Orain the Bastard of Driftmark, Lord Stademan, called Pennylover, hundreds of others. Those who had changed their allegiance during the battle needed only to swear fealty to Joffrey, but the ones who had fought for Stannis until the bitter end were compelled to speak. Their words decided their fate. If they begged forgiveness for their treasons and promised to serve loyally henceforth, Joffrey welcomed them back into the king's peace and restored them to all their lands and rights. A handful remained defiant, however.
"Do not imagine this is done, boy,"
warned one, the bastard son of some Florent or other.
"The Lord of Light protects King Stannis, now and always. All your swords and all your scheming shall not save you when his hour comes."
"Your hour has come right now." Joffrey beckoned to Sir Ilyen Payne to take the man out and strike his head off. But no sooner had that one been dragged away than a knight of solemn mien, with a fiery heart on his surcoat, shouted out, "Stannis is the true king. A monster sits the Iron Throne, an abomination born of incest." "Be silent," Sir Kevin Lannister bellowed. The knight raised his voice instead. "Joffrey is the black worm eating the heart of the realm. Darkness was his father and death his mother. Destroy him before he corrupts you all. Destroy them all. Queen Whore and King Worm, Vile Dwarf and Whispering Spider, the False Flowers, save yourselves!" One of the gold cloaks knocked the man off his feet, but he continued to shout, "The Scouring Fire will come! King Stannis will return!" Joffrey lurched to his feet. "I'm king! Kill him! Kill him now! I command it!" He chopped down with his hand, a furious, angry gesture, and screeched in pain when his arm brushed against one of these sharp metal fangs that surrounded him. The bright crimson samite of his sleeve turned a darker shade of red as his blood soaked through it. "Mother!" he wailed. With every eye on the king, somehow the man on the floor wrestled a spear away from one of the gold cloaks and used it to push himself back up to his feet. "The throne denies him!" he cried. "He is no king!" Cersei was running toward the throne, but Lord Tywin remained still as a stone. He had only to raise a finger, and Sir Meron Trant moved forward with drawn sword. The end was quick and brutal. The gold cloaks seized the knight by the arms. "No king!" he cried again, as Sir Meron drove the point of his long sword through his chest. Joff fell into his mother's arms. Three maesters came hurrying forward to bundle him out through the king's door. Then everyone began talking at once. When the gold cloaks dragged off the dead man, he left a trail of bright blood across the stone floor. Lord Baelish stroked his beard while Varys whispered in his ear. "Will they dismiss us now?" Sansa wondered. A score of captives still waited, though whether to pledge fealty or shout curses, who could say? Lord Tywin rose to his feet.
"We continue,"
he said, in a clear, strong voice that silenced the murmurs.
"Those of you who wish to ask pardon for their treasons may do so. We will have no more follies."
He moved to the Iron Throne, and there seated himself on a step a mere 3 feet off the floor. The light outside the windows was fading by the time the session drew to a close. Sansa felt limp with exhaustion as she made her way down from the gallery. She wondered how badly Joffrey had cut himself. They say the Iron Throne can be perilous cruel to those who are not meant to sit it. Back in the safety of her own chambers, she hugged a pillow to her face to muffle a squeal of joy.
Oh, gods be good, he did it! He put me aside in front of everyone!
When a serving girl brought her supper, she almost kissed her. There was hot bread and fresh churned butter, a thick beef soup, capon and carrots, and peaches in honey.
Even the food tastes sweeter, she thought.
Come dark, she slipped into a cloak and left for the guardswood. Sir Osmond Kettleblack was guarding the drawbridge in his white armour. Sansa tried her best to sound miserable as she bid him a good evening. From the way he leered at her, she was not sure she had been wholly convincing. Dantos waited in the leafy moonlight.
"Why so sad-faced?" Sansa asked him gaily.
"You were there, you heard. Joff put me aside. He's done with me, he's—"
He took her hand.
"Oh, Jonquil, my poor Jonquil, you do not understand. Done with ye? They've scarcely begun."
Her heart sank.
"What do you mean?"
"The Queen will never let ye go, never. You're too valuable, a hostage. And Joffrey, sweetling, is still king. If he wants you in his bed, he will have you. Only now it will be bastards he plants in your womb instead of true-born sons."
"No,"
Sansa said, shocked.
"He let me go, he—"
Sir Dantos planted a slobbery kiss on her ear.
"Be brave. I swore to see you home. And now I can. The day has been chosen."
"When?"
Sansa asked. "When will we go?"
"The night of Joffrey's wedding. After the feast. All the necessary arrangements have been made. The Red Keep will be full of strangers. Half the court will be drunk, and the other half will be helping Joffrey to bed his bride. For a little while, you will be forgotten, and the confusion will be our friend."
"The wedding won't be for a moon's turn yet. Margaery Tyrell is at Highgarden. They've only now sent for her."
"You've waited so long. Be patient a while longer. Here, I have something for you."
Sir Dantos fumbled in his pouch and drew out a silvery spider-web, dangling it between his thick fingers. It was a hairnet of fine-spun silver, the strand so thin and delicate, the net seemed to weigh no more than a breath of air when Sansa took it in her fingers. Small gems were set wherever two strands crossed, so dark they drank the moonlight.
"What stones are these?"
"Black amethyst, from Ashai. The rarest kind. A deep true purple by daylight."
"It's very lovely," Sansa said, thinking,
"It is a ship I need, not a net for my hair."
"Lovelier than you know, sweet child. It's magic, you see. It's justice you hold. It's vengeance for your father."
Dantos leaned close and kissed her again.
"It's home."
Bran. The oldest were men grown, 17 or 18 years from the day of their naming. One was past 20. Most were younger, 16 or less. Bran watched them from the balcony of Maester Luwin's turret, listening to them grunt and strain and curse as they swung their staves and wooden swords. The yard was alive to the clack of wood on wood, punctuated all too often by thwacks and yowls of pain when a blow struck leather or flesh. Sir Roderick strode among the boys, face reddening beneath his white whiskers, muttering at them, one and all. Bran had never seen the old knight look so fierce.
"No," he kept saying, "no, no, no."
"They don't fight very well," Bran said dubiously.
He scratched Summer idly behind the ears as the direwolf tore at a haunch of meat. Bones crunched between his teeth.
"For a certainty," Maester Lewin agreed with a deep sigh.
The Maester was peering through his big mirrorish lens tube, measuring shadows and noting the position of the comet that hung low in the morning sky.
"Yet given time, Sir Roderick has the truth of it. We need men to walk the walls. Your Lord Father took the cream of his guard to King's Landing, and your brother took the rest, along with all the likely lads for leagues around. Many will not come back to us, and we must needs find the men to take their places."
Bran stared resentfully at the sweating boys below. If I still had my legs, I could beat them all. He remembered the last time he'd held a sword in his hand, when the king had come to Winterfell. It was only a wooden sword, yet he'd knocked Prince Tommen down 50 times. "Sir Roderick should teach me to use a poleaxe. If I had a poleaxe with a big long haft, Hodor could be my legs. We could be a knight together."
"I think that unlikely," Maester Lewin said. "Bran, when a man fights, his arms and legs and thoughts must be as one."
Below in the yard, Sir Roderick was yelling,
"You fight like a goose. He pecks you, and you peck him harder. Parry! Block the blow! Goose fighting will not suffice. If those were real swords, the first peck would take your arm off."
One of the other boys laughed, and the old knight rounded on him.
"You laugh, you! Now that is gall. You fight like a hedgehog."
"There was a knight once who couldn't see," Bran said stubbornly, as Sir Roderick went on below. "Old Nan, tell me about him. He had a long staff with blades at both ends, and he could spin it in his hands and chop two men at once."
"Simeon Star-Eyes," Lewin said, as he marked numbers in a book. "When he lost his eyes, he put star sapphires in the empty sockets, or so the singers claim. Bran, that is only a story like the tales of Florian the Fool, a fable from the Age of Heroes."
The Maester tisked.
"You must put these dreams aside. They will only break your heart."
The mention of dreams reminded him. "I dreamt about the crow again last night, the one with three eyes. He flew into my bedchamber and told me to come with him, so I did. We went down to the crypts. Father was there, and we talked. He was sad."
"And why was that?"
Lewin peered through his tube. "It was something to do about John, I think." The dream had been deeply disturbing, more so than any of the other crow dreams. "Hodor won't go down into the crypts." The Maester had only been half listening, Bran could tell. He lifted his eye from the tube, blinking.
"Hodor won't
go down into the crypts. When I woke, I told him to take me down to see if Father was truly there.
At first, he didn't know what I was saying, but I got him to the steps by telling him to go here and go there. Only then he wouldn't go down. He just stood on the top step and said, 'Hodor,' like he was scared of the dark. But I had a torch. It made me so mad I almost gave him a swat in the head, like old Nan is always doing." He saw the way the Maester was frowning and hurriedly added, "I didn't, though." "Good. Hodor is a man, not a mule to be beaten.
In the dream, I flew down with a crow. But I can't do that when I'm awake," Bran explained.
"Why would you want to go down to the crypts?"
"I told you, to look for Father." The Maester tugged at the chain around his neck, as he often did when he was uncomfortable.
"Bran, sweet child, one day Lord Eddard will sit below in stone, beside his father, and his father's father, and all the Starks back to the old kings in the north. But that will not be for many years, gods be good. Your father is a prisoner of the Queen, in King's Landing. You will not find him in the crypts."
"He was there last night. I talked to him."
Stubborn boy," the Maester sighed, setting his book aside. "Would you like to go see?"
"I can't. Hodor won't go, and the steps are too narrow and twisty for Dancer."
"I believe I can solve that difficulty."
In place of Hodor, the wildling woman, Osha, was summoned. She was tall and tough and uncomplaining, willing to go wherever she was commanded.
"I've lived my life beyond the wall. A hole in the ground won't fret me none, my lords," she said.
"Summer, come," Bran called as she lifted him in wiry, strong arms. The direwolf left his bone and followed as Usher carried Bran across the yard and down the spiral steps to the cold vault under the earth. Maester Lewin went ahead with a torch. Bran did not even mind, too badly, that she carried him in her arms and not on her back. Sir Roderick had ordered Usher's chain struck off, since she had served faithfully and well, since she had been at Winterfell. She still wore the heavy iron shackles around her ankles, a sign that she was not yet wholly trusted, but they did not hinder her sure strides down the steps. Bran could not recall the last time he'd been in the crypts. It had been before, for certain. When he was little, he used to play down here with Rob and John and his sisters. He wished they were here now. The vault might not have seemed so dark and scary. Summer stalked out in the echoing gloom, then stopped, lifted his head, and sniffed the chill, dead air. He bared his teeth and crept backward, eyes glowing golden in the light of the maester's torch. Even Usher, hard as iron, seemed uncomfortable.
"Grim folks, by the look of them," she said, as she eyed the long row of granite Starks on their stone thrones.
"They were the kings of winter," Bran whispered.
Somehow it felt wrong to talk too loudly in this place. Usher smiled.
"Winter's got no king. If you'd seen it, you'd know that, Summer Boy. They were the kings of the north for thousands of years,"
Maester Lewin said, lifting the torch high so the light shone on the stone faces. Some were hairy and bearded, shaggy men, fierce as the wolves that crouched by their feet. Others were shaved clean, their features gaunt and sharp-edged as the iron longswords across their laps.
"Hard men for a hard time. Come."
He strode briskly down the vault, past the procession of stone pillars and the endless carved figures. A tongue of flame trailed back from the upraised torch as he went. The vault was cavernous, longer than Winterfell itself, and John had told him once that there were other levels underneath, vaults even deeper and darker, where the older kings were buried. It would not do to lose the light. Summer refused to move from the steps, even when Usher followed the torch, Bran in her arms.
"Do you recall your history, Bran?"
the maester said as they walked.
"Tell Usher who they were and what they did, if you can."
He looked at the passing faces, and the tales came back to him. The maester had told him the stories, and old Nan had made them come alive. "That one is John Stark. When the sea raiders landed in the east, he drove them out and built the castle at White Harbour. His son was Rickard Stark, not my father's father, but another Rickard. He took the neck away from the March King and married his daughter. Theon Starks, the real thin one with the long hair and the skinny beard, they called him the Hungry Wolf because he was always at war. That's a Brandon, the tall one with a dreamy face. He was Brandon the shipwright because he loved the sea. His tomb is empty. He tried to sail west across the Sunset Sea and was never seen again. His son was Brandon the Burner because he put the torch to all his father's ships in grief. There's Roderick Stark, who won Bear Island in a wrestling match and gave it to the Mormonts. And that's Torrhen Stark, the king who knelt. He was the last king in the north and the first lord of Winterfell after he yielded to Aegon the Conqueror. Oh, and there, he's Craegan Stark. He fought with Prince Aemon once, and the Dragon Knight said he'd never faced a finer swordsman. They were almost at the end now, and Bran felt a sadness creeping over him. Oh, and there's my grandfather, Lord Rickard, who was beheaded by Mad King Aerys. His daughter, Lyanna, and his son, Brandon, are in the tombs beside him.
Not me, another Brandon, my father's brother. They're not supposed to have statues. That's only for the lords and the kings. But my father loved them so much, he had them done.
The maid's a fair one, Usher said.
Robert was betrothed to marry her, but Prince Rhaegar carried her off and raped her, Bran explained. Robert fought a war to win her back. He killed Rhaegar on the Trident with his hammer, but Lyanna died, and he never got her back at all.
A sad tale, said Usher, but those empty holes are sadder. Lord Eddard's tomb, for when his time comes, Maester Lewin said. Is this where you saw your father, in your dream, Bren?
Yes. The memory made him shiver. He looked around the vault uneasily, the hairs on the back of his neck bristling. Had he heard a noise? Was there someone here? Maester Lewin stepped towards the open sepulchre, torch in hand.
As you see, he's not here. Nor will he be for many a year. Dreams are only dreams, child.
He thrust his arm into the blackness inside the tomb, as into the mouth of some great beast.
Do you see? It's quite empty.
The darkness sprang at him, snarling. Bran saw eyes like green fire, a flash of teeth, fur as black as the pit around them. Maester Lewin yelled and threw up his hands. The torch went flying from his fingers, caromed off the stone face of Brandon Stark, and tumbled to the statue's feet, the flames licking up his legs. In the drunken, shifting torchlight, they saw Lewin struggling with a direwolf, beating at his muzzle with one hand while the jaws closed on the other. Summer! Bran screamed. And summer came, shooting from the dimness behind them, a leaping shadow. He slammed into Shaggy Dog and knocked him back, and the two direwolves rolled over and over in a tangle of grey and black fur, snapping and biting at each other, while Maester Lewin struggled to his knees, his arm torn and bloody. Usher propped Bran up against Lord Rickard's stone wolf as she hurried to assist the maester. In the light of the guttering torch, shadow wolves 20 feet tall fought on the wall and roof.
Shaggy,
a small voice called. When Bran looked up, his little brother was standing in the mouth of Father's tomb. With one final snap at Summer's face, Shaggy Dog broke off and bounded to Rickon's side.
You let my father be,
Rickon warned Lewin.
You let him be.
Rickon, Bran said softly, Father's not here.
Yes, he is. I saw him.
Tears glistened on Rickon's face.
I saw him last night.
In your dream? Rickon nodded.
You leave him. You leave him be. He's coming home now, like he promised. He's coming home.
Bran had never seen Maester Lewin look so uncertain before. Blood dripped down his arm, where Shaggy Dog had shredded the wool of his sleeve and the flesh beneath.
Usher, the torch, he said, biting through his pain.
And she snatched it up before it went out. Soot stains blackened both legs of his uncle's likeness.
That beast, Lewin went on, is supposed to be chained up in the kennels.
Rickon patted Shaggy Dog's muzzle, damp with blood.
I let him loose. He doesn't like chains.
He licked at his fingers. Rickon, Bran said, would you like to come with me?
No, I like it here.
It's dark here and cold.
I'm not afraid. I have to wait for Father.
You can wait with me, Bran said. We'll wait together, you and me and our wolves. Both of the direwolves were licking wounds now and would bear close watching.
Bran, the maester said firmly, I know you mean well, but Shaggy Dog is too wild to run loose. I'm the third man he's savaged. Give him the freedom of the castle, and it's only a question of time before he kills someone. The truth is hard, but the wolf has to be chained, or...
He hesitated. Or killed, Bran thought. But what he said was, he was not made for chains. We will wait in your tower, all of us.
That is quite impossible,
Maester Lewin said. Usher grinned.
The boy is the lordling here, as I recall.
She handed Lewin back his torch
and scooped Bran up into her arms again.
"The Maester's Tower it is."
"Will you come, Rickon?" His brother nodded.
"If Shaggy comes too," he said.